Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, tragedy in Mississippi. Two people were killed and 10 others injured as a giant crater opened up. 50 to 60 feet wide, 20 to 30 feet deep. You had seven cars and a motorcycle. Ground just opened up because of Hurricane Ida. Highway 26 West shut down traffic, well, completely, because you now have a giant sinkhole crater that swallowed all this stuff up. And look, you know, the hurricane, this is the hurricane, but it's also the fact that our infrastructure hasn't been rebuilt in decades and isn't prepared for the climate change and the storms that are coming. Even in a place like Mississippi, where they get hurricanes regularly, it's going to get worse, which is why we need major, major investment. That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's good to be with you as always.
So I'm looking at this giant hole, and the pictures are, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. They had to get a crane to pull people out of this giant sinkhole. And it's because we haven't invested in our infrastructure and we haven't done the things that we need to do to prepare us for what's coming.
Yeah, you're right about that. And obviously you're right to point to the hurricane as the precipitating event. But like with a lot of things, there's a backstory to this as well. And that backstory is two or threefold. Number one, our infrastructure is old. Bridges in particular, we have tens of thousands of bridges that are deficient because they were built to last for a set amount of time and we're well beyond that time span. Number two, the construction that was done wasn't done with resiliency in mind, the ability to withstand major events like this. I mean, you know, I know there are some localities, some states that have stricter codes for things like this because they're either in earthquake zones or more recently, you know, in the face of hurricanes. But by and large, that hasn't been a factor when constructing in the past. And then the third factor is obviously the fact that even though people talk about this all the time, you know, Washington has done not much to move the needle forward on any of these issues until very recently. And, you know, I remain hopeful. Be interested to see how you feel about infrastructure as well. But I'm optimistic that we can get something across the finish line before October the 1st that will allow a rebuilding of bridges, roads, other infrastructure, and to do it in a way where unfortunately we have to face reality, which is we're going to have more major events like this, and we need an infrastructure that's going to be resilient and able to withstand all of that as well.
No, absolutely, and it's something we need to be doing now. And I look at the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that I don't think is sufficient. I think we need much more. In fact, the Society for Civil Engineers has come out and said we need $4.6 trillion in hard infrastructure stuff, and we need it now. And I don't think the $3.5 trillion plan is enough because we've neglected our infrastructure and our human infrastructure for decades. So this is just kind of a small catch-up. I mean, the numbers are staggering, but it's a small catch-up for years of neglect.
Yeah, this is a down payment. I mean, it gets us from failing grades or C minuses up to something that is a little more acceptable, but that is not great. And I think this is the thing, you know, I'm an American exceptionalist in some ways, in other ways, definitely not. But in some ways I am, where we should be leading the world in this. We should be showing the way how this is done. But when you look all around you with the physical infrastructure, most of the great examples of the 21st century are not in the United States. And we're instead playing catch up. So you're right. This infrastructure bill is kind of a down payment. And everybody, you know, in a couple of years will say, well, those guys just got their hands on a bunch of money. And Rick, you're absolutely right. It's not enough. I mean, that was like the first installment. But we do have a long not only on roads and bridges, on other forms of physical infrastructure, as you mentioned, like school buildings, waterworks, broadband, and the list goes on, in addition to ensuring that we have the social infrastructure in place so that people don't get whipsawed during catastrophic events or economic downturns as well.
No, absolutely. But here's the thing, and this is the thing that's concerning to me, is, you know, we're looking at all the shortages that we have in our supply chain. You look at all of the things that they're telling us we don't manufacture or can't manufacture. And I go, you are in this moment where we need massive investment. We need, you know, we need tons of steel and cement and you name it. We need stuff to build stuff. And yet we don't have the manufacturing capacity at this moment to do it. Now, that doesn't mean I don't believe we can't build it. But at this moment, we don't have it.
Right. Yeah, there's shortages not only of semiconductors, but of a lot of critical materials and other sorts of goods as well. And there are two fundamental reasons for that. One is that we've been in this crazy time, obviously. The second is that we lost a lot of that capacity. And when you're not making the stuff, you're not first in line. I mean, the home country, the home region, they're going to take care of themselves. And this is exactly what the government in Beijing has done with all the multinational companies that located there. It's like, wait. You're going to take care of us first, and then you can help the rest of the world. So if, for instance, you know, the majority of the world's semiconductors are made in China, or 70% of the lithium-ion batteries, that definitely creates a leverage problem. And I think this administration understands that, and they understand that in a way that has an urgency to it, is that we do have to build up this capacity in a hurry in the United States so that we're not at a point where we're over leveraged, so that we can mitigate some of this political risk, but also so that we can have a smooth running economy and supply chain for complex things like automobiles, which we do. You know, we build great automobiles when we have the parts. So if we make more of those parts in America, we're not going to have the same challenge.
No, I'll tell you, I wish we made more auto parts in the U.S. because the ones that we get from China are junk. I've got a friend who's a mechanic. He says, you know, half the parts I pull out of the box are no good out of the box, let alone you put them in and you go through five starters to get one that works. I'd like us to have some quality control and some pride in the work that gets done. It's just we're in this weird spot that we've allowed corporate America to go chase the cheapest labor, the most exploitable environmental conditions. And what it's done is it's created this, the consumer's screwed, working people are screwed, the country's screwed. And now we got to dig out of this huge mess. And what's coming out of Washington, I still don't believe is enough. And I know people are going to say, oh, you want to spend all this money. Yeah, because we need to invest.
Yeah. And even then, Rick, it's still billions versus trillions, and the trillions being the money that the Chinese Communist Party and the government of Beijing puts up to prop up its own industries. Not only does it prop up its own industries through subsidies, it owns a bunch of them, too. So we're approaching nothing close to that. But if I'm confident that we don't need all of that money that China deploys, because I think we can do it more efficiently. But we do need a big boost, because otherwise, again, you know, we make something like 11 or 12% of the world's semiconductors right now. We make 1% of the world's solar panels right now. We make 7% of the lithium-ion batteries in the world right now. And that is just that's completely inadequate, particularly when we want to grow those sectors of the economy. So it does take a plan. I mean, these companies, if they were going to have an act of altruism where they said, you know what, we're suddenly patriots, we're going to bring this stuff back to the United States, they would have done that a long time ago. No, it takes incentives, it takes policy, and it also takes a market. Biden wants to build the market. You got to provide the right incentives, and you need the policy, like procurement, like buying American, to go along with that. And we need to lean in on that. And to me, this isn't a partisan issue. This is about making economically and from a national security point of view as well. So we ought to be able to get Democrats and Republicans behind policies like
on the national security front. I mean, our cyber infrastructure is so far behind and lacking. Our broadband access is pathetic, and I'm not thrilled with what they've done on that front in the infrastructure bill by just handing money over to corporate America and ensuring that my local community can't build out things that they need. There's so much that we should be doing that sadly lobbyists and the moneyed interests have figured out how to play this game. And this is where, you know, I'm hoping at some point we as the working class of this country wake up to the reality that we're divided at every opportunity, and that where we need to unite is on this stuff, because this is about national security. This is about the future of the country. And you look at, you go back to what happened today in Mississippi. You got roads that just are going to open up. I mean, is this going to be one of those moments where every day we're going to be worrying about which roads are opening up or bridges are collapsing or what's tragedies next because our infrastructure is failing us?
Yeah. Well, yes. And I think for the average citizen who may not think about semiconductors the way that auto executives do or others certainly is going to be concerned about getting around town safely and having the ability to do that.
Right, especially if we're going to all EVs. I mean, if eventually we're going to go to electric vehicles.
Right.
You know, I had a caller, you know, recently go, hey, we can't go to electric vehicles because we're hyper-dependent on China for all of these chips and this wirings and all this stuff. We don't make any of this stuff. So what are we doing? Are we trading Middle East oil for Chinese electronics? We're still no better off. And I don't know that I disagree with them.
Right. Well, they're right about that, which is why for a long time, we have been advocating for Buy America provisions for the federal spending, you know, if you want a charging infrastructure and you want the federal government to pay for some of it, it's got to be made in America. Like, I think that's our point of view. Same with broadband. You want to build out broadband in your community, that fiber optic cable needs to be coming from the United States of America. And guess what? There are steelworkers in North Carolina who work for Corning who make this. So this is about well-paying jobs as well. And so you need that policy. You're right. If you just, if you're like California and you're just going to mandate electric vehicles, you don't care where they come from, you're going to give China a leg up because they are so far ahead in building out the supply chain. And unfortunately, they provide these massive subsidies to their companies that you need a procurement policy as well. It's like, yeah, consumers, we're going to give you an incentive if your electric car is made in the United States of America. And I think that's a really, really smart way to go. That's the way we're going to get back into the game.
Yep. No, and on every manufacturing front, but on the climate especially, because there's such an opportunity here to remake our economy in a way where people get good paying union jobs, where we're not trading for poverty wage jobs, that there's an opportunity for people to get ahead. But that we do make it here because we've got to address climate change. There, something has to happen. I don't know if you saw it today, but California evidently has closed all of their parks.
Right.
All of the national parks are closed because they're going too many fires. We just can't deal with it.
Yeah. So on the clean energy front, and we talked about electric vehicles and the catch up we have to do there. One thing that gives me some hope is that the big automakers in the United States have committed to EVs in the future, and we're going to make darn sure that they're manufactured in the United States. We're playing catch up on solar. You know, 1% of the world's solar panels are made in the United States. We need to boost that up, and with wind power generation as well. And for a long time, people have probably been seeing those big wind turbines go up either offshore or in some parts of the country. You know, I know they're, you know, in Western Pennsylvania. You can see them. I was driving through the state of Indiana a couple weeks ago. There's miles and miles of them. Not a single one of those is made in the United States. And so you have to have a policy that says we're going to manufacture these in the United States. And guess what? It works. You know, just within the last, 4 or 5 weeks, we've seen some big announcement. Sparrows Point, which you know well in Baltimore, from a Bethlehem Steel. They're going to be fabricating steel for offshore wind turbines there, creating hundreds of jobs. A major wind farm deployer just announced that they'll be manufacturing a substation to bring that, because you have to have a way to get that power to shore. You know, they're going to be manufacturing the first one of those in the United States. So we're slowly but surely making progress. And Rick, to me, this is proof that if you have the policy, if you want to have the demand there, you know, you're saying this power has to be clean or these vehicles have to be electric. You also need the manufacturing policy to go along with it, the incentives for the manufacturers, and then also the rules that say these have to be made in the United States of America.
No, and this is where I think Joe Biden has done a really good job, and I'm thrilled that they're pushing in the right direction. Are there some things that I'm not thrilled with in that bipartisan bill? Yeah, there's a lot of stuff, but that's what sure. you get. It's what you get Absolutely. With bipartisanship.
Right. Yeah. It's. I mean, if you would have wrote the bill, if I would have wrote the bill, we'd do it completely different. I don't want to make the perfect be the obstacle of getting something done. And it's not even like we'll have to hold our noses on this, because there's a lot of good stuff. There just isn't enough.
Right.
There's a few stinkers in there, but nothing that is completely and totally outrageous like the trade-offs that Clinton and Gingrich made back in the 90s. There's nothing that approaches that. So let's get this over the finish line. Both of these important pieces of legislation, the physical infrastructure, and then the investments in our future, in our people, and in our clean energy, and in our manufacturing as well.
I'm right there with you. Scott, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Keep up the great work that you guys do there at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Thanks so much.
All right, Rick. Take care. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work yourself. Appreciate it.
You too, brother. Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, americanmanufacturing.org. Quick break, right back. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.